Hi guys, welcome back. My name is Mello Garcia, and most of you may or may not know me, but I am After Chloe. Welcome back. So I have another amazing speaker here today for the After Chloe and Friends online summit. And as I've mentioned many times over the course of the last few days, I don't bring anyone on unless there's someone I consider to be a friend. And this is another new friend. I've gotten a lot of questions. Well, are you bringing back so-and-so, and why didn't you bring back so-and-so? And I wanted to bring in people that have really had an impact on me personally, professionally, over the course of 2019 and 2020. And this next speaker is someone that I'm really inspired by. I think he's an amazing guy. He's got an amazing, adorable family. They're just so cute and awesome. Every single one of them. I love the husband he is, the father he is. Just, I think he's kind of like a brother type figure. I'm very drawn to that. He's really down to earth. We haven't had a lot of one-on-one conversations, but I really resonate with his content, with the way that he speaks. Earlier this year, he did me a wonderful favor of speaking in my kind of pop-up Facebook group that we've kept open because obviously the pandemic is still not over. And he really just kind of gave me a lot of soothing. And believe it or not, during that day, he had like a power outage and he was just kind of like experiencing all these types of different challenges in the day. And he just did a really great job of just handling it with grace and ease and calmness. I wish I could give that over to Chloe's dad. And so what I have found is I kind of seek him out for that male energy and just how to handle a male and how to handle male energy. And personally, he helps me a lot, and he probably doesn't even know what till I'm about to say it is that with Chloe's dad experienced the loss of his sister on June 5th, and she died very suddenly. She was only 48 years old. And so Chris Wilkins, actually a lot of his content, it's really helped me to really be there for Chloe's dad and his grief and his loss. And I know you may be going, well, what do you mean? You're a grief specialist. You're someone who deals with grief and loss every single day. But I think that there are different types of energy. And if you were talking to someone who is a lost parent, or you're talking about somebody who's lost their parent, I am very well equipped. And I believe that as a grief specialist, I feel very comfortable, but there are certain types of loss that I feel kind of foreign and unable to speak on. And so the loss of my sister-in-law was extremely close to me. And Chris personally, without him even knowing it, a lot of his content has really helped us. And my husband loves to watch him. Chris is also very much a guy's guy, so he does a lot of outdoor stuff, and so he probably doesn't realize how much we watch his social media, but we are big fans, and we're friends on Facebook, and my husband was like, today you're gonna interview my friend, and I said, yes, I will let him know that you think that he's your friend. But Chris is also a licensed social worker, and you can definitely tell he's caring and he's compassionate, but he's tough when he needs to be. And that's what we need in all social workers. And he's a doctoral student in behavioral health at ASU, which is Arizona State University. ASU is one of my favorite universities, by the way. I didn't realize that until right now that I'm reading it. He graduated ASU with a master's degree in social work and has been working in the field of addiction and mental health treatment for 15 years. Chris is the founder and clinical director of Hobby Creek Behavioral Health in Springville, Utah. And I think that that's another reason they all like to be out in the woods. I only like to go out there when my photographer forces me. And I take a ride out there in an SUV, and then I get quickly back into the vehicle. I'm not one of those girls. I don't want to be in the dirt at any time, ever. And let's see, he has so many professional, his bio will be listed below, and he has so many professional credentials, and I could list them all. And just like every single one of these speakers, they are very well qualified and experts in behavioral and mental health. But when you can speak grief fluently, I think that that makes you a different type of human. And so I will leave it at that. So welcome, my friend. Welcome, Chris Wilkins. Here in the Garcia household, you're very loved. If you didn't know, we're your fans.
I did not know that. And so I'm already kind of a ball baby, but hearing that, I did not know that. So hearing that, I am touched, I am moved, and I very much appreciate that feedback. We do this work for that very purpose, is to have an impact on people. And the impact is not, the intent is not for me to have the impact, but for the impact to be there. And so I'm just so grateful to have made this connection with you, and to know that things are helping, things are helpful and beneficial. So yeah, I appreciate being here. I'm so grateful for you.
So there is a song by Khalid and Drake. I don't know if you listen to them in your pickup truck or your Jeep.
I do every once in a while. Yeah.
I'm going to get teased a little bit, but
I sure do. Yeah.
I could tell you got down that way with you. Yeah. And Mike. I could tell you guys get down and boogie.
Yep.
But Drake and Khalid have this song, and I've been getting the lyrics wrong the whole summit. And yesterday I was on with one of my speakers and I was like, she's like, he's cussing. He says a cuss word. And I'm like, Katie, no, he doesn't. He doesn't say a cuss word. She's like, yes, he does. So I listened to the song last night and he does. He's like, 2020 came to F it up. So he's right. Drake is right. Khalid is right. Yeah. Right? It's true. And I'm a little embarrassed because I was like, you know, I've been saying that song the whole summit, but I mean, they know I like the F word. So I mean, what it, but 2020 has been quite a year, right? I mean, I don't even know how to describe it in words properly. I've tried, from the pandemic to the racial tension to the election to people losing. I mean, I cannot name one person that I haven't spoken to that hasn't lost something, a situation, a material thing, finances, the stressors, health, the fears, the anxieties. There's so much, right? So where do we start? I mean, do you think... Do you think it's made people more compassionate? What do you think about all of this?
I really do. To answer that question just real bluntly, I do think that there are so many people who have been invited and welcomed into that. I don't know if you want to call it a sect or a pact of just being a compassionate human. And over the last maybe month or so, here in Utah, it's been a trend, especially, but to focus on the things that we have gratitude for, the things that are good. And I know there's a lot of information about like toxic positivity and all of that, and how we don't want to be too positive and that things are too perfect. And I understand that. I know that we need to be within reason. But in this year, this entire year, we've had so many reasons to be negative, to be critical, to be down and discouraged. And so here over this last month, many members of our community here, and myself included, we've been trying to focus on what are some of those good things. And it doesn't mean that we're ignoring the pain and the loss and the suffering and the discouragement and all that. But I very much believe that whatever we focus on, it grows, it multiplies, it gets bigger, it gets badder. And so if we can look at some of the good, then I think that's going to multiply as well. Now, I think that there are parts of us, our existence, that has become cynical, that maybe we have become pessimistic because we've been watching all of this pain. And for many of us, we've lost people to COVID. Many of us have lost individuals, or we ourselves have lost people to other health issues. There's been significant job loss. I have some people very close to me who've lost businesses. They've lost their homes and have started to look at bankruptcy and things of that nature. Many people who this has led to so much stress that marriages and families are struggling as a result of it. And so we can acknowledge all of the chaos and acknowledge that I think some of us have become a little bit cynical and frustrated, I think, in that pain and in that trauma. But I have been astounded and so touched at the number of people that I'm watching and the intensity of the compassion that is coming out. I've seen so much giving this year, and it's really a great breath of fresh air to know that even in the midst of so much negativity, there's a lot of giving. There's a lot of love out there. It's very, very cool.
I love your answer. There's just something about you that's so soothing and calm, and like you make me come, like I'm always kind of elevated. Like I'm always like, if anybody that knows me, like I'm a lot, and I'm always like at 20, and you always kind of make me come back down to 10, and I just want to take a deep breath, and I'm like, you know, like I am closing my eyes and kind of humming along to your voice. I absolutely agree with you. In what you do and what I do, like I live in this. Like obviously I don't want to be like, I know what it's like to be in a pandemic, because I don't, but I do understand what it's like to live in a world of losing daily. I do know what it's like personally and professionally to watch people cry and have to say goodbye to their loved ones, to their, what they believe their lives were, what they thought their lives were on many different levels. So to see it globally, it's almost been where I've had to remove myself, because it was almost too much for me to take in, just because it was too much to digest. And so I've really had to go to a place of daily asking myself, what can I do to be proactive in this? And a lot of times it will be to remove myself from physically coming on camera or from being as active as I was on social media or after Chloe doing at the level what it was doing prior to the pandemic. And it's because I really had to kind of gain my own footing or to kind of gear up to decide, because the summit was supposed to be an in-person summit this year. And so we were planning on asking you to come to Scottsdale or asking you to come to Orange County this year versus, you know, doing this in an online space. And so I had to kind of grieve that and come to terms with that myself. And also the grief of the loss of my sister-in-law, somebody so important in my life pre and post Chloe. And in doing all of that, I realize it's okay to take a step back and it's okay to gain my own footing before I can help anybody else across the bridge. And that leads me into the question, do you think that it's important for people to really kind of breathe it in? And while it's wonderful to be positive and do what they can, like, you know, paying for people's orders behind them or giving toothbrushes and food to homeless where they can, or giving dog food to people when they don't have food for their animals or things of that nature. Maybe they sound like small things, but for a lot of people, they're huge things. But in addition to that, to really kind of gather themselves emotionally, spiritually, and in their, to become mindful and present versus just to kind of keep on going and acting as if nothing is wrong, right? There's a big difference between what me and you are saying versus to avoid it all and to use, you know, things to fill that void or to, you know, like, you know, they're gonna drink a 24 pack of you know, Miller Lite or whatever beer's out there, you know, or 805. I've been seeing 805 at the Costco's and the Sam's Clubs, 805. I didn't realize it was a beer until I went and read what is this, but 805, and really understanding that, you know, they have to kind of take it all in Do you think that's important, or do you think it's just kind of important to just go by moment or by moment, or what works for you?
For me, there's not a definitive cookie cutter answer. And I know that's kind of the cookie cutter answer in and of itself, isn't it? We're all different. And one thing in my, I believe it was the first semester of graduate school, I had a professor who's an unsung hero. I sing her praises often, and every once in a while we'll share a message with her on social media or something. But her name is Dr. Joanne Cacciatore, and she had significant loss as a mother, and channeled that pain into a mission, into a purpose. And in her course, I learned quite a few things. One of them is that we can't force somebody into that pain. We cannot force them into feeling. We can't force them into experiencing, but that we get to be with them. We get to show up as a compassionate presence and work with them on their terms, at their speed. Now, as a therapist, I think it's important to recognize that oftentimes people will not do this on their own because how difficult it is. Some people miraculously will navigate through the healing and with the grieving and the healing process on their own with the supports that are around them. And that just amazes and inspires me. So many of us, I think we struggle to do that without a little bit of outside help. And that outside help doesn't mean it's a therapist or a coach or something along those lines. It could be a book. It could be some loved ones. It could be the routine of work or education or raising children or whatever those things are in our lives. And I think some of that consistency can be very helpful, not necessarily healing, but I think helpful in the process. And so I'm a big advocate for feeling. I'm a big advocate for getting rid of the distractions and the things that are in our world that would lead us to deflect from our pain and to not feel it. However, I also know that we cannot break the dam. We cannot release the floodgates. That becomes too overwhelming. There is a clip on YouTube. I think there's many, many of them now because people will do them kind of in their own style. But essentially it's talking about the brain and how we can only handle a certain amount of stress. And I teach this with addiction as well. But specifically with our stress, we can only tolerate so much before we, I guess, quote unquote, lose it. We flip out. We go off the deep end. And so that's something as a therapist I'm very mindful of, that there's only a certain threshold that each of us can handle. And there's no judgment around, I can handle more, therefore I'm better, or I can handle less, so I'm not as good in any way. It's just different. It just is. And I think one of the things that's just really important is that we recognize as a therapist, as I'm navigating with people through their pain, I've got to know when to press pause or redirect, reroute the situation. I do give an example of every once in a while we'll be getting into that pain. It's really intense. It can be really heavy, really deep. And I'll start talking about like the pain color, just as an example, something so trivial that has nothing to do with anything. And most of the time I don't share with people ahead of time that about that method. And every once in a while people are like, I just imagine in their minds, we were talking about my loss. Like, why are we talking about sports or the paint or the weather? But I do that for about 30 seconds, maybe a minute. And then we veer right back into that pain, into that loss. And what it's done is it's like a set break. If somebody's working out at the gym, it's just taking a little breather where the brain and the heart will exhale, and then we can lean into it again. And I love that cadence. It's almost an exciting thing for me to recognize what people's cadences are, because we all differ, we all vary, and we also vary from topic to topic. You know, we all have very, very different forms of loss and types of loss. And some things that I've lost in my life were not as big of a deal as some of the other experiences that I've had. And on another note, there are times in my life where I can maybe the word handle, I can handle or tolerate or deal with or feel things more or less successfully than at other times in my life. There's a ton of variables that go into that. Sleep, our diet, stress, work, and all of those different things. But one of the, I think, really important things for us to do is to recognize that, yeah, I think we've got to feel that we can't avoid it, but we have to do it meticulously, which there's not a right way to do it. I think there's a lot of wrong ways to do it. I don't know that there's necessarily a right way overall. And that's one reason that I'll say, hey, let's talk about it. Let's look at it. Let's ask some questions and explore, and then create a plan. And that plan is going to change over time. There are times where one of the modalities that I use, or the treatment techniques that I use for trauma, is called EMDR. And there are times where we'll set out with a plan to do EMDR, you know, for the next 4 weeks, and we'll get week one, and it's phenomenal, it's amazing. And somebody comes back in week two and they say, I don't want to do that anymore, or at least not today. Can we just talk today? And then we'll jump back into it next time. And I say, absolutely, you're the boss. You run the show. You're in the driver's seat. I'm the passenger. I might be maybe the navigation device, but ultimately you've got to make the decision as to, do you take my instructions or my navigation directions, you know? So yeah, we do need to feel it, but I think we need a little bit of planning and a little bit of compassionate support in that effort.
Absolutely. You know, it kind of leads me into, you know, when I watched your live that you did in after Chloe's pop-up group in, I want to say it was in June or May or June. And when you came on, you know, it can be an incredibly lonely time. And I would like to talk about that not being past tense. I mean, there's still so many people feeling that loneliness on a Tuesday, on a Wednesday, you know, the first day of Hanukkah, Christmas Eve, a birthday, an anniversary, a death date. There's so many various milestones that someone can be facing. And loneliness comes when we look at the loss and we think about, this person is no longer physically, tangibly, I can't touch this person, I can't call this person. And that can be very triggering for a person to feel so very alone. And it's almost impossible to tell that person, don't feel that way. Why are you feeling like that? Or trying to get a person to compare their loss to, like, I've had a lot of times clients that someone will have a death of their pet dog. And then someone will have a death of a loved one. And a lot of times someone with the death of a loved one will be angry that someone's so upset about the death of their pet. And I always try to, like, again, explain, you can never compare a loss. And even with ourselves, we have to show gentleness not to compare. Like, you know, we were in a really great state of mind at one point in our lives where, you know, we're eating right and we're getting vitamin D and we're grounding and we're meditating properly and we're praying and, you know, and I'm all together. Well, you know, in 2020, yeah, it came to get down and it definitely took me out of all of my, you know how everyone's like, I've got a morning routine. I'm like, well, that went out the window 5 months ago, 7 months ago. And I'm just barely, we're lucky that I think these are like four day curls, you know, like I'm just lucky if I can get a brush through here. And if I'm honest, that's all I can give. And if I'm honest, if I sit there and I try to compare my loss of my daughter, Chloe, to the loss of my mother, to the loss of my father, that's really an unfair analogy. That's unfair to myself. And so I've got to also give that same grace to others where everyone's just kind of trying to do their best. And I don't know if you'd agree with that, Chris. Like, we all tend to want to bring someone else into it. And our loss and our grief is not about anybody else. I don't know if you'll agree with that. But the loneliness of it, I used to think if I was in a room full of people, I wouldn't feel lonely. But I still felt so very alone. And it had nothing to do with anybody else that was there. It was just that my mom and my dad and my daughter weren't there. It wasn't their fault. And I've learned with Chloe's dad, he's grieving his sister. He's grieving his daughter. It brings up a lot of triggers. And so no matter, I'm there and I'm going to continue to be there. I mean, he probably tries to run and hide from me and watch Chris's videos, but no matter what, he still feels that aloneness, that loneliness. And I don't want to speak for him or break, you know, it's not fair to him because he's not here speaking, but I have his permission. He doesn't have a choice. He's Chloe's dad. We put it all out there. But so what do you think about all of that? Like, do you think that what I'm stating is valid? Or do you think, what do you think about aloneness and loneliness and comparing our own grief and loss and feeling like we should be at these milestones or these points versus we're not? Like, you know, 2 years ago, I was like in a morning routine. I would run. I did a 5K. I can't even walk down the street without huffing and puffing. That's where I'm at.
Yeah, I totally hear that. I think that especially around the holidays, we are at risk for that struggle. I think holidays can be really difficult, even when things are going well in life, even when we have reasonably healthy and positive and engaging familial relationships or friendships with people. I saw a question posed, I think the week of Thanksgiving, and it said, in four words or less, how could you best ruin Thanksgiving dinner? And I was crying laughing at the creativity that people have. Going from, you know, from the election to COVID to so many other issues. You know, we have political things, religious things, you know, those hot topics that we say those are a no-no at the dinner table or at Thanksgiving dinner. And then we add in, we haven't seen each other in the same way for so long. We've been so disconnected. So what I'm saying is around the holidays, there's already, I believe, a heightened risk for loneliness, for comparing and contrasting our own circumstances with the neighbors or with others. There are times where even in a seemingly healthy, happy situation, we might have those unfortunate feelings of, I wish I had more, or I wish it was different. I've heard many people say things along the lines of, this is okay, but, or I hate my life, or I hate this. And those are paralyzing feelings. Those are really intense. And sometimes we say them, maybe not considering everything in our world. Sometimes we say them and it's absolute truth, where there's such an intense struggle. I think now, this year, especially the holidays, I think there's a lot of loneliness. And I think the things that we do in response really, really determine where we're going to end up in the next several months. Meaning, for some, when we start to feel lonely, we might reach out to friends. We might start, you know, texting a bunch of people and saying, hey, how's it going? You know, I want that interaction. And they don't know. It's just, hey man, how's it going? What's up? How are you guys doing? How's your family? How's work going? And I can receive that connection that way in those responses. Other times we might go to the gym. We might turn on a show. We might connect with a loved one in some other way. Other times we turn to alcohol. We turn to drugs. We turn to the casino. We turn to some of these things that would bring potentially some consequences, some struggle into our life. And one of the phenomenons that I've noticed in this work is, I use a lot of I statements. And this doesn't necessarily mean this is my pattern. And sometimes it does mean it's exactly my pattern. But as I run from my grief, as I run from my pain, from my trauma, from my loss, I jump into, again, sometimes healthy and sometimes incredibly unhealthy, dangerous behaviors to numb out, to check out. And there are times and have been times where we find ourselves with even more grief, with even more pain, more consequence, more sorrow than what we were running from to begin with. I believe fully that we have no idea what we're doing in that situation, in that scenario. We don't know that we're driving blindly into danger. We can't anticipate the consequences that are coming from that, because in that loss, in that pain, in that trauma, in that suffering, we don't care. I just need a change. I just can't feel this. Okay. And so I believe that we can get into a really unhealthy and detrimental cycle of re-traumatizing ourselves, or becoming re-traumatized by, whether we want to call it the system or society or our own choices, whatever, what have you. And I think earlier, as we were talking about compassion and love and generosity, I think that's where it can be so impactful to have those individuals in our life who will reach out and say, hey, how are you doing? Like, how are you really doing? Let's go for a ride. Let's go X, Y, and Z. You know, let's go to the movie. Or I don't know what it's like in your community, but we can go to the movies sometimes here. We can go to restaurants here sometimes. There's a lot of restrictions, but it's been really important for me to get creative in how we can navigate through some of this stress. One of the other things that you mentioned was comparing. I use a term, I really don't know who invented this term. Anyone listening, if you know, please send this my direction. But the Trauma Olympics, it's one of my favorite terms to use when we're talking about this. Because as I hear somebody say, here's my story, here's what I've been through, there's a part of me in my heart that wants so desperately to connect with that and to empathize with that, that I'll allow myself to feel it. But sometimes I might find myself interrupting and starting to tell you my story, starting to tell you what my experience has been. And it very well could come across to you as I'm hijacking, right? I'm taking over. I wasn't really listening to you. I was just waiting for you to be quiet so that I could share, right? Again, I think there's that noble desire for us to connect and be on the same page, to gather together and say, hey, yeah, I know what that's like. This really sucks. Keep going. But in our effort, we might fall a little bit short, and it may just come across wrong. So I love to use that term, the Trauma Olympics, and really, really dissect what that looks like, how I choose to believe that we're all doing our best. I choose to believe that we're all on this path together. We're all at different stages. We all have different resources and strengths and weaknesses and what have you. But when we get into that, maybe comparing, we really set ourselves up. I personally believe we've all done it. I personally believe that we've all been there. And again, I believe the intention was to connect and to help somebody feel like you're not alone. You don't have to go through this alone. You have me. I'm here for you. But so often what we say is like, yours doesn't matter as much. Let me tell you my story. So I'll probably do that in the future. You know, it's not one of those things where we say, oh, now I learned. Now I saw that I did it. I'm never going to do it again. I learned my lesson. We're talking about human connection. We're talking about human conditions and trauma and pain. They catch us off guard all of the time. So I think that's one thing that we can just pay attention to and notice when we have different feelings that come up for ourselves, how it's effective for us to communicate and connect with other people, and maybe some of the things that we'd be more disconnecting, you know.
When I was in school, when I was in my master's program, I started to learn about person-centered therapy. What was it, Carl Rogers? Yeah, Carl Rogers. And I hated it. So guys, just so you, everyone watching, so person-centered therapy, or a person-centered approach to therapy for therapists is that they allow the person to just kind of feel and talk their way through. And the therapist is just supposed to allow them without like getting nothing other than empathy. So really like a therapist is just supposed to sit there and go, really? And how do you feel? And okay, how do you feel? And how do you feel? Well, you can imagine me after Chloe, because you know, I like to talk. And so like, I get really long-winded. So when we were in our internship, you have to go through and you have to do so many hours in Cal. You have to do a lot of hours. And God bless him, he passed away. But the guy that I was training under, he was like, Mello, I don't want you to talk. Now you need to let the client talk, okay? And they would watch us through like this. It was like a, I guess they're called double-sided windows where you could see. So the guy was like, and I mean, this poor guy had been through so many things. And so they were, the clients would be talking and I'd be like, And like my face, and like, I'd start crying. Like, I mean, it was awful. And I was like, I can't do that. Like, I have to tell them my daughter died. You know, like you just want to like relate and connect and like hug them. And you're not supposed to do that. I mean, you're supposed to have congruence. You're supposed to have like connection. You're supposed to feel empathy, but you're supposed to allow the client to come to their own resolution of their issues. And obviously I do not use I don't mean to laugh, but I think back and like I used to cry because I was like, I'm not meant to do this because I'm not, I want to fix, right? Versus support. And that was a really big lesson for me because I'm not here to fix. I have to be here to support. I'm not here to tell you what you're feeling. I'm here to support and honor and witness. And so it's really kind of like, it's almost like gagging somebody and forcing them to sit there and to like learn how to support and witness. And know that and it's amazing to talk to people that have gone through so much loss and grief and them know nothing about you and them know that you're not going through the same thing. And there is no comparison. And they have no idea that you could even possibly understand what they're feeling. And while I'm not a fan of the person-centered approach, it taught me the most. I don't know how you feel about the person-centered. Do you know what, you know which approach I'm talking about, Chris?
Yeah, I do. I do. And this is fascinating because, so we have three master's level interns that are here at Hubble Creek, and we have four other master's level therapists that are here at Hubble Creek. And so I do a lot of supervision. It's one of my passions is helping, you know, new therapists or future therapists, what have you, as they come into the field. And it's one of those things that just, I think it keeps me honest. I think it keeps me on my toes, making sure I'm not practicing bad habits because I certainly don't want to teach bad habits. And so this topic that you're bringing up, it came up yesterday in one of my supervision meetings with one of my interns. And I love this conversation, and I'm in my 30s. I have been, I still feel like a rookie in many ways. I was a clinical director for 5 years before I opened this clinic here. I've had a lot of great experience. I've had some of, you know, I was trained by what I consider to be the best treatment center in the world. And of course I'm biased. Of course I think we were the best, right?
Well, no, but I think I would agree with you though. You come from a very strong therapeutic roots. Absolutely. Like I said, you have a very strong, like ASU is one, to me, ASU is one of the strongest mental health educational sectors that we have in our country in terms of bringing out some top therapists and therapy programs that are in relation to grief and loss. Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. I'm gonna give you that compliment without you even saying, I understand what you're saying. You're trying to actually be modest, but don't, because you come from a wonderful sector. And then Utah as a state, you guys have such amazing mental health programs, whereas California, Arizona, and Nevada has pretty good, you know, because I have a dual license. I have licensure in Nevada. Nevada's an amazing state for mental health. Like, obviously they're aware of it. But Utah is a very rich state in terms of they care about mental health, and it's in your legislature. It's in your license, your state guides. And it also is in your health regulations. And so for me, I think that you coming from there, you're coming from a superb place to start with. So, you know, then go from there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I bring that up because, you know, when I was in school, in fact, one of my, I think, first presentations as a graduate student was on the use of self in therapy. And I think I ruffled a lot of feathers. I think that I said some things or presented on some things that maybe, can I use the word the establishment, or can I use the word maybe like old school, is like, no, you do not do that. And I'm going, I'm not going to be a rock. I'm not going to be a cold stone as these people who I care about, who are trusting me sometimes with their life, who are trusting me with their deepest, darkest secrets, their terrors, the things that have utterly destroyed them, destroyed their faith in humanity, their faith in a higher power. You're telling me I can't, you know, have a facial expression. You're telling me I can't cry with them. You're telling me that I can't say, ooh, that's really hard. I know that pain. You're not alone. You know, that old model is like, no, you're just a stone. You're just stoic. You know, it's not about you. Well, you're right. It's not about me. But there's a whole lot of middle ground between, I wrote down fix versus support earlier. There's a whole lot of middle ground between I'm just going to be like a robot and support them in whatever they're doing. Because if I'm a robot, what are you paying me for? Why are you coming here?
Right. And if they're a danger to themselves, right? Like if they're a danger, if you're like in danger, like it's not about fixing, but it's to like talk them off, you know, that I don't even want to say the word, but to talk them off that, you know, where they're teetering, you want to pull them back a little bit and say, hey, what about this? Or what about that? Or what about this? And so using examples, even if they're hypothetical, to me, I am connected to you because you share certain parts of your life. I would not be connected to you if it wasn't for social media. I would think, he's another therapist.
We're a dime a dozen. You know, there's so many that are out there, and that's wonderful and that's great. You know, really in Utah, we're actually experiencing a shortage of therapists, which is it's kind of surprising to me. Yeah, we have a shortage.
But don't you think that's because therapy is encouraged in Utah?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I think that more people seek care, which is really good. I think there's a greater willingness compared to maybe some other communities. And I've either lived in Utah or Arizona my entire life. And so I don't have a whole lot to compare and contrast to. It's more of research and other people, you know, word of mouth. But I bring that up. This middle ground, kind of this gray area between just supporting people to do whatever they're going to do and then fixing it. You know, I'm also not only in recovery, but I'm also recovering codependent. And maybe that's where some of that social worker, that therapist comes in, and I can maybe channel it in a way. I'm not doing the work for anybody. I'm not a fixer. I'm not a healer. And I know that there are some popular terms in our society. I know there are some things that you know, have some hashtags and have some, you know, they're the hot topic words and terms that people like. I'm not really a big fan of those. I look at this as the opportunity to meet somebody where they are. So my view of person-centered is I'm centering on the person and what they need.
I love
some of my people, and I don't love patients or clients as terms. I say people, my friends, my folks, something like that.
Yeah,
you know, that ruffles feathers too, because those who train me said, they're not your friends.
Yeah.
And I'm going, well, I'm not going to hang out with them. I'm not going to Topgolf with them or to the movies or something.
Right.
I'm going to be friendly.
Right. And Chris, do you think, I love that. And I, because I, this is a very, and this is why, from very early on, I'm like, you cannot heal my grief and loss. And when people are like, you know, the buzzwords are on their sales pages or for their courses or for even for treatment, they'll be like, I want to heal your grief. And that's one of the questions I wanted to ask you today is, what is your stance on healing? Because I don't believe that I'm sitting here thinking, anyone watching with me, and guys, I hope you're still with us, because I know we kind of went off, because I get excited when I, because I love to pick his head in terms of, because I really love his form, his style of treatment. And I, that's why I like can talk to him, because he knows like the lingo per se. And I just love to, I like talk to him forever. But going back to healing, I really love your perspective on healing. And I'd love you for you to share with the audience today that I don't believe that there is healing of grief and loss. And I know you guys are going to clip that, and that'll probably go up on somebody's Instagram story. But in context, I believe that we live with our grief and our loss, just like I believe I've been in recovery for 17 years. And
congratulations.
I know that every day I've got to keep coming back and I've got to work on my sobriety. But do I think I'm healed? No. Because if you put my drug of choice in front of me and I don't have the resources and the recovery and the tools that I need, I would go right back to that drug of choice. And I don't believe I'm healed from it. I believe that I've recovered from it. I believe the same way about grief and loss. I believe it lives with you. I believe it's triggered. I believe sometimes it comes back. I believe sometimes you feel through it. I believe you move through it. And that's what I think of when I think of you, Chris. I believe you move through things. But that doesn't mean that it's not there. What is your take on healing and grief and loss? And do you believe we heal from that? I mean, do you believe you heal from an emotion and a feeling?
I do believe we heal. I don't believe many of us are healed. I believe that we're in that process now. I've done a lot of work around my pain. And I had gotten to a point in my life where I thought I was healed, where I thought it was all better. And a short time ago, things in life took a left turn. And some things began to occur. I began to understand some things that were happening to somebody who I love more than life itself. And I was sitting talking with my wife one night, and I said, you know, I thought I was done. I thought I'd done my work. I thought I'd healed. I've got some more work to do. And the ability that I had to just say that and have somebody in my life who didn't freak out, who didn't panic, who didn't judge me, was so incredibly comforting. So to answer again, I do believe in healing, and I very much believe, whether it's my trauma, whether it's addiction, whether it's mental health, whether it's whatever, what have you, I believe that we will heal someday. I think that most of us are somewhere along the path. We're on the journey. And, you know, we hire therapists, we interview interns, we bring different people into work, whether it's here in the trauma clinic, or we have a nonprofit as well. And we have all volunteers in the nonprofit. I'm not just saying, you know, send us a job application and come on in. I want to know, why do you want to be here? Why do you want to do this work? Department of Labor is a wonderful organization, right? They limit us in some of the things that we can ask in a job interview. I support that. But I also know that they're, we all are better off if we have the right fit with the individuals that we work with and collaborate with as colleagues, or, you know, people that we rub shoulders with. A long time ago, somebody suggested to me, here are the questions you cannot ask in a job interview. Here's what you can ask. So the question was posed, have you done your work? And I loved that. As a therapist, I know we know exactly what that means. Have you done your work? I have yet to meet a therapist. And I should say, I have yet to work with a therapist or get to know a therapist on a deeper level than just, I see you once a year at a conference or something like that. So I've yet to meet a therapist at that level who did not get into this field for a very deep reason. I believe that we find ourselves here because of purpose, because of the pain that some of us have experienced. And sometimes it's because we're looking for healing, and hopefully we get that. I think other times people have done their work and have gotten to a place where they can then, with compassion, with love, with experience, share the message. They can reach people in a way that is unique, that is different than any other. You know, we talk about bedside manner with physicians. I think therapists and coaches and counselors and individuals on in that realm are very similar. There's a bedside manner. There's a legitimacy, maybe a factor that way, where if we've been there, we know what that looks like. We know what that feels like. And when I sit in the presence of an individual who's been there, I can feel that. I can sense that. And I immediately exhale. I immediately go, I'm safe here. I had a conference call this morning with a residential treatment center here in Utah who I've known. I've met them at conferences. I've gotten business cards and things that way. And we scheduled a Zoom just kind of a meet and greet to tell them about us and for him to tell me about their program. And right away we hit it off. We connected. And it was one of those things where he shared a little bit of his story, and I'm going, this is my guy. This is my kind of person. And we had one of just the greatest conversations that I've had in a long time about this work, about trauma healing, about recovery, about being in hell and having somebody reach their hand out and say, I'm here, grab on, and yank us up, for us to get that work done, and then in return to pay it back, go find somebody else who's in that hole and reach our arm out and grab them and give them a leg up or give them a hand up to be able to do the work, to do that healing. So yeah, we're all works in progress, and some days we are having just a great time, and we are on fire. We are well, we are spiritually connected, and people can sense it. There's a light about us. And then other days it is, oh no, what is going on? What is happening? You know? So yeah, I personally have faith that there will be a day where I can be around my, if we want to call them vices, my struggles, my addictions, my all those things. And my heart won't start racing. I won't start breathing heavily. My reactions won't be that way. But they are now, and I get to do something about it. I get to respond. I get to respond in the way that I was taught, the way that works for me, the ways that work for me. And those are some of the things that I teach my clients, the people that I work with, my friends, right? I give them those same things of, you know, not necessarily here's my program, why don't you go do this? But as we're in these proving grounds, here are some things that have worked for me. I'd like you to try them. Let's see how it goes.
So every year, this is the fourth year that I've done the After Chloe and Friends online summit. And the whole goal is to, again, give support. So people get a glimpse of someone like you. They are connected with people around them that they can seek for support of their grief, of their loss, of recovery, of trauma, of addiction, of any issue that they're having with their mental state of mind. And I didn't feel like it was right to do the normal tagline, the normal theme, which is finding your life of living after loss. And so living and grieving was kind of what I wanted to go towards, but I knew that I really kept thinking of the word resilience. And again, you know, we mentioned these buzzwords and everyone's kind of been like, yeah, that's a great word. And, you know, all the powers that be on my team are like, Mello, you're coming along. You're finally getting on the program. You know, you're getting into that brand. And I'm like, well, after Chloe's not a brand, it's my way of life. It's paying honor to my daughter that died. I only do what I do is because I want someone else to know that, you know, I'm like a cat. I've lived like 8 lives. I should have died. I should have died in my addiction. I should have died all the times that I try to commit suicide. I should have died every time it just didn't work out with some man. I should have died with my second husband that almost killed me so many different times, and the domestic violence that I lived in secret. But I didn't. I made it through. I should have died when I was gang raped when I was 23. I should have died, but I didn't. I made it through. So resilience has like such a meaning for me, Chris. And I feel so connected for that word with you. But I don't want to state the definition. So I'd love to know what resilience means for you. I'd love to know what is your definition of resilience, of living and grieving?
A moment ago, well, let me say this. You're right. I think many people having experienced those traumas, whether the physical trauma of those events, the assaults, is what kills us, or the psychological terror that comes as a result of it leads to our death, leads to our destruction. I very much believe that there is purpose. I believe that it's troublesome to say casually that everything happens for a reason. The term that I like better is we can create reason, or we can create purpose from the pain. A friend said to me, I don't think she invented this either, but she's who I heard say it. She said, you turn your mess into a message. And I like that a lot. That brings chills to the back of my neck as I think about that concept, as I think about the symbolism of that. Resilience to me is not that I can walk through, or I can run through the gauntlet and be unfazed, but it's the gauntlet can throw me to the ground and I will continue to get back up, whether that's me putting my hands on the ground and physically crawling or standing back up, or allowing somebody in my life, in my circle, to pick me up. You know, there are times in my life where people have maybe gone to give me a hand to pull me up, and I've kicked them. Maybe I've metaphorically spit on them and said, get out of here. I don't need you. I don't need your help. Maybe I've shut down that support and I've shut down that love. And that can be so catastrophic. That could ruin so many of our relationships. And I think that can also jeopardize our some of our future relationships, even just based on our experiences with trust and loyalty and things like that. But resilience to me, a moment ago, I mentioned being in hell and having somebody reach their hand out. And in my life, I've started to use this other analogy that's related when I think of resilience. I imagine somebody, and I've seen this out there in the world lately too, so you may have heard it. But I imagine somebody who, again, has been in hell, has made their way out somehow, and has miraculously found a bucket and filled it with water, and they're running back into those flames to try to put them out. Because there are a ton of people still there, still in that hell. And so if I make it out, it's all well and good. I have no obligation to go back in. I'm not expected to go. I'm not accountable to anything. But that resilience is, I know what it's like in there. And those are my people. Those are my friends. Those people need me. And so as long as I'm safe, as long as I'm well and healthy, I'm going back in. To me, that's resilience. I think that sometimes we go through hard things and we think, okay, I'm never going to have to do this again. Or the next pain is not going to be as hard. But I actually sometimes think the opposite. I think that some of the hardships that we experience are teaching us. And based on our response to them, based on how we proceed through that pain and through the healing process, I think it almost is preparing us for other things that may occur in life. And heaven forbid they occur to us. Heaven forbid they occur to our loved ones. Maybe it is just strictly for this calling or for this working in this field. Then we get to be that resilient force for others. But I do know that we're not exempt from pain just because we've been through it. I do know we're not exempt from pain just because maybe life was good. So I don't have those kinds of experiences or something like that. The universe doesn't really decide who's going to experience trauma or pain. You know, I think those are natural occurrences. A long time ago, I saw a license plate holder that said, pain isn't optional, suffering is. So also when I think of somebody who's resilient, I think of somebody who's learned to accept that things can be painful, things can be really hard and really challenging, even to debilitating, but we don't have to suffer for very long. I think we can get into the healing process and do that work. That work's really hard. It's not fun to do. It's not the exciting stuff. It's not pleasant. But I continuously am looking at what my retirement is going to be, or if you want to call it my heaven, or my, you know, the results of my my vision board. You know, what's on my vision board? It's all of those wonderful, blissful, amazing things. And right now, I'm just putting in work. I'm just doing what I've got to so that I can end up with those things and in those ways. But I'll be damned if I'm not going to enjoy some of those things today along the way.
Absolutely. I think you gave a great example, you know, after Chloe and friends, I know this is the fourth year. Like, this is a hard work. It's hard work, guys, putting on this summit for you guys, but I'm very proud of it. You know, what I do, it's a great thing. What all these speakers giving their time, their energy. But not to say that I don't imagine Chris in person and getting to hold space with him and his family and him getting to hold space with Chloe's dad and all of that. Absolutely. But I think it's important for us to enjoy the moment. And so why was I not going to do a summit? Well, I was upset that I wasn't going to get to do an in-person one. So I had to really pivot. And I love what Chris says, is that absolutely, you've got to enjoy what you have in the moment. And I think that resilience, that is a great definition of resilience. You've got to find what you can in the room and You know, you may say, well, I want a quilt, and you may only have a cotton blanket in the room. Well, you know what? Does that mean that you're going to go cold, or are you going to cover yourself up? And, you know, it's up to you. But I hope that you will take the advice of Chris Wilkins. I hope, doctor, right? You're a doctor. Are you a doctor already? Are you
no, doctor? Not yet. That's somewhere in the future.
That's on your vision board too, though, right?
That's on my vision board. My plan is to start classes again next fall. Yes. I took an extended break because we have a couple of youngsters. We've got some little ones and I changed jobs and left the residential world and became my own boss. And so I needed to change my priorities a little bit.
I love it.
Yeah. So someday I'll get there.
Someday. So I hope you guys will check out Chris Wilkins. Chris, it has been an honor and a pleasure to interview you. I appreciate you so much. And guys, thank you so much for watching. I hope you got as much as I did out of this time with Chris and his talk and all of his, I won't even say bits, his pieces of knowledge and his pieces of insight. And he speaks grief fluently and beautifully. Like I told you, my friends are awesome and amazing. So thank you. Thank you, Chris Wilkins. I so, so appreciate you. We appreciate you on behalf of After Chloe and Friends. We appreciate you. And thank you for being my friend. And guys, thank you so much for watching and tuning in. We've still got a lot of speakers. I know I say this every single time. I don't know if I can top this. I don't know, but I'm going to try. I'm going to keep trying to show up for you guys. I love you guys. I will see you guys on the next interview. Maybe I'll comb my hair. I don't know. Maybe. I'm not promising anything. I'll see you guys soon.